Hello and welcome to The Wire, your independent national coverage of current affairs right across Australia on Community and Indigenous Radio. I'm Amina Shakur coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. And today on the show...
There's subsequently no local maternity services and there's been ones close to home that have closed as well.
Half of rural maternity services have closed, increasing birth risks.
People, a visa like this is a kind of a safety net.
A new climate visa offers Tuvaluans mobility to live in Australia. And later today...
So I'm very happy to be here, very happy to have this statue around me and this beautiful crown on my head.
We'll speak to the crowned Mr. and Miss NAIDOC 2025. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. Half of rural obstetric services have closed since the 1990s, leaving some areas as obstetric deserts where 1 in 50 births happen on the roadside. A new framework urges restoring services and highlights risks like premature births and burden of travelling for care. The Wire's Sihan Wang asked Alicia Stainis, founder of the Maternity Consumer Network, what this means.
Yeah, the National Maternity Consensus Framework really was a consensus amongst 10 organisations. It had been produced quite some time ago, so it was due for a refresh. This time it included a broader range of groups, but also importantly consumer groups, so on behalf of women. And it really is signifying not just the importance of rural birthing, but some steps on how to maintain and ensure that rural women and their families can birth close to home.
What opportunity did MCN take to decide to carry out this framework?
2023, there was a forum in Canberra. It was around rural maternity services, and one of the action items from that was around creating the Rural Maternity Task Force and consensus framework. And we are pretty broad from a committee perspective. There's women who've had rural metro births and everything in between. But as someone who founded the organisation, I actually grew up in a rural area. There's subsequently no local maternity services and there's been ones close to home that have closed as well. So for me, it was something that was a bit of a passion project and something close to my heart because I've actually had that reality and lived experience of rural birthing. I've got six children. My first was in a small country town, and I think it was one of my best experiences because of the relational care. And this is often what is missing in a metro centre, and it's very hard for metro people to get across when you're kind of explaining what it's like to live in the bush because they often think isolation, poorer services. But one thing you get is community. And it's the relational care that you often can't get replicated in the metro centres because you'll see your midwife, you might play sport with her, you might, you know, the same with my doctor who ended up coming in for birth as well. You'll run into them at while you're doing your grocery shopping, and it'll be a little, great to see you, how's things going? So it's that incidental care that you get in the community that's not just appointment based. The other thing that I loved about it was the home visits, which often, a very small number of women actually get to have that continuity of carer. So having a known midwife, like reality show becomes real life. There's only a small portion of women that get that, but I was really fortunate. And as a first time mum, what it did for me was set me up really confidently, but to have that care provider come into my home, whether it's a hearing test or wait for baby or checking on breastfeeding, and it's not, an appointment by the clock. It's really an appointment. What do you need? I'm meeting you where you're at. And that's what I think a lot of these rural centres can provide for women when they're set up well, that we don't often have in our metro centres.
Before this framework, have you and your organisation team members observed any key issues of these problems?
Yeah, for many years, actually, we've actually run a few campaigns on rural maternity services, so bush babies campaigns, like trying to bring birthing back. Outside of just rural women, we actually have a cohort of First Nations women, high populations in rural and remote areas, that it's really important for them culturally to birth in their community.
What are the main improvement directions proposed in this framework?
Well, obviously, local access, respectful maternity care. We know that a third of women experience birth trauma, and some of that trauma for rural women is that having to relocate, transfer hospital, separation from baby. Respectful maternity care, culturally appropriate care, like I mentioned before, so birthing on country and community, and having continuity of carer. So that can be continuity midwifery carer with that known midwife model. But what we want to ensure, if women have higher risk factors, they also want to see the same doctor. And so it really is continuity of care, no matter your risk level. Like, you shouldn't miss out just because you're a woman who, might have health issues, or a baby that might have health issues, and you need doctors as well as the midwives. You should not lose that familiar face. And that's really what we want, because that relational care has the best outcomes.
How do you hope the public will understand the significance of this research?
I think we need to look at just plain data. We've had nearly half maternity services close. We've had, in some rural areas, a three or fourfold increase in BBA, so that's born before arrivals. And we also know, from a healthcare spending point of view, that rural people actually have about $850 less per head than their metro counterparts. So that's government healthcare spending is not getting into these communities. So that's where we're seeing health disparities too. And then some of what we do from an advocacy perspective is be going to state and territories and the federal government and say, what are you doing to implement this framework? Like, where is your monitoring and evaluation? Where's your timeline to make sure that we're actually getting re-establishment? But we can't just have frameworks, consensus, policy sitting collecting dust. We actually then need to have a translation implementation plan.
Alicia Stainis, founder of Maternity Consumer Network, speaking to Sihan Wang. Many gathered at Perth Crown Ballroom on Saturday night to watch the crowning of Mr. and Miss NAIDOC 2025. The Development and Leadership Program started 15 years ago, which encourages participants to culturally grow, be confident, and become leaders within their communities. This year's winners were 21-year-old Noongar woman Shera Oki Ugle and 21-year-old Noongar man Jaden Marsh. National Indigenous Radio Services reporter Micah Kickett has the story.
I am absolutely astounded at the young people, your ability, your capacity and your strength. To us, as an elder, I speak for a lot of elders, I'd say that you're being held by the elders, but also you young people are holding us. We're moving on in years, and I don't mind stepping aside for young people to come through, because you must come through. You must walk with pride, you must walk with dignity, and you must walk with the one word that I hold very dear, and that is with integrity.
And Auntie Glenda, tonight we are at the Perth Crown Casino to find out who will be crowned Mr. and Miss NAIDOC. How are you feeling?
I'm feeling very excited and, very proud.
And you also said earlier, when you gave a bit of a speech to, the participants, you said that you're also feeling a bit emotional because this is the 15th year that this program has been running, and you actually created it with Shannon Maguire.
Yes, that's right. We started 15 years ago with nothing. We had an idea and we thought we would run with it. We got a little bit of money from the Department of Aboriginal Affairs in those days, and it was so successful that first year. We only had four girls, but it's just grown and grown every year, and now we've got Mr. NAIDOC participating, the young men I should say, and it's just taken another facet from there, and I'm just so proud of the program and the young people that participate and see them grow and develop, and this is a new journey for them.
Briar Pickett. Nerves have gone out the window, so yeah, just looking forward to being up on stage with everyone and seeing how it all goes tonight.
B. Ashwin. Some of the stuff we learnt in the workshops, we learnt values, communication, We even spoke about grief and emotions, so just everything within the workshops is something I'm going to take back with me.
Bronson Richards. Yeah, I'm not nervous at all. I'm actually quite excited. You know, it's a great opportunity, but you know, it's a lot of pressure too. But pressure means something's expected of you. So, looking forward to giving all the old people a show and showing them, you know, that younger generation's got something to show.
My name is Lawrence Fuster. I'm feeling excited. Nervous, but I'm ready to, you know, gain more out of the experience, and I'm ready to flourish.
What's the thing that you're going to take away from this experience?
I think what I'm going to take away from the experience is the experience. So if there, maybe I don't win, but look, I'm a winner anyways, because I'm actually continuing the program and I've finished it. And so I'm learning so much about myself and my peers that are doing the program as well. So it's a win-win situation. So no matter what happens, I'm going in there with an open mind and just eagerness to learn. So
Cherokee Eagle. To be honest with you, I'm feeling really excited for tonight. I'm just really looking forward to who gets crowned Miss or Mr. NAIDOC. I know it's going to be a really good night, seeing friends and family in the crowd supporting us and being with the girls on the night as well. That's really exciting.
What's the one thing that you've learned that you'll take away from this program?
At the end of the day, we're all going to be brothers and sisters. We're all already leaders in our own communities. And despite the outcome, if I don't get crowned Miss NAIDOC, we're already winners in our communities. We're already emerging leaders. We're always going to be a voice for our people. And that's something to really take into account and keep that in the front of your mind and really be proud of who you're going to be representing at the end of the day.
Tonight is about celebrating the achievements of 12 of our young Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander men and women in Perth, who are tonight's Mr. and Miss NAIDOC Perth finalists.
Mr. NAIDOC Perth for 2025 is Jaden Marsh. Miss NAIDOC for 2025 is Cherokee.
I'm here with my brother, Jaden Marsh, who has been crowned winner of Mr. NAIDOC. Brother, how does that feel?
It's one of the best feelings in the world, brother. You can't beat being recognised in a community this big and this honourable. It's one of the greatest honours you can get as a young Aboriginal person in this community, man. So I'm very happy to be here. I'm very happy to have this statue around me and this beautiful crown on my head. All glory to God, all glory to my family. Big thank you to Muzz and the working group. Everyone's brought me through this so far, and a big thank you to my brothers, Bronson, Lawrence and Brian. You've done amazing, and they're all as deserving to wear this sash and crown as I am, yeah, 100%.
Now I'm with Cherokee Eagle here, winner of Miss NAIDOC 2025. How does that feel, cuz?
I am honestly speechless. I'm beyond excited. Honestly, I just had just no words, because when I heard my name, I just couldn't believe it, and I just had to really live in the moment. But I'm just so freaking happy, and I just want to be like a role model for our mob and just really stand up for us and what is right. And I'm just speechless, honestly. I'm so happy.
And you should be, because, you know, it's been a journey. And I remember you saying, you know, how you were very shy at the beginning, and look at you now, you know, taking out the crown, taking out the title.
Yeah, honestly, I started out as being shy. I didn't really want to, like, get to know anyone. And I just didn't have that confidence. But because of Miss NAIDOC, I've really developed that confidence, and I just backed myself and just really trusted myself.
That was Micah Kickett with the story. You're listening to The Wire, independent current affairs on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Amina Shakur in Melbourne. A big hello to our listeners in Alice Springs on 8CCC 102.1 FM, and to our friends in Noosa on Noosa FM 101.3, and to the other side of the country to Radio Gulari in Broome, Western Australia. A new permanent visa for Tuvaluans is already in full swing, and a third of the population has entered into the ballot. The climate visa pathway to allow Tuvaluans to work, study and live in Australia, and unlike other visas, it does not require a job offer. While most of Tuvaluans may decide to stay at home. The pathway allows Tuvaluans some mobility with Australia to support their communities and families. The Wire's Eduardo Jordan asked Director of the Evacuation Research Hub at Calder Centre for International Refugee Law at University of New South Wales, Jane McAdam, to explain more about this visa pathway for Tuvaluans.
Well, this is a new visa that's been created pursuant to a treaty between Australia and Tuvalu, which is designed to enable up to 280 people from Tuvalu to move to Australia each year on a permanent basis. Now, the visa itself doesn't mention climate change, but the treaty that it was created under is framed around the existential threat that climate change poses to our region. And so that's why the visa has kind of acquired the nickname of a climate migration visa.
Very interesting. So what's the current situation in Tuvalu with climate change at this point?
Well, Tuvalu is certainly feeling the impacts of climate change and disasters, both through sudden onset impacts like saltwater inundation, flooding, erosion, cyclones, those sorts of things, and also the interaction with longer term impacts such as sea level rise. That said, even though those impacts are being felt now, certainly not everybody wants to leave their homes. And even though we've heard that up to a third of the population has registered to apply for one of these visas, we need to be cautious about what that means, because for a lot of people, a visa like this is a kind of a safety net that can enable them to have an opportunity to move to Australia, but it doesn't necessarily mean that everybody is desperate to get out. In fact, most Pacific Islanders would prefer to never leave their home, but also might want to take up opportunities for education or work in Australia, and also know that longer term, they have this kind of security blanket of being able to move to Australia on a permanent basis if they need to.
Now, besides climate change, which is one of the main topics of this pathway, what are some of the factors this visa is provided to Tuvaluans as well?
So there are a very few eligibility requirements for this visa, in contrast to most of the other Pacific visa pathways that exist to Australia or New Zealand. Normally, they are labour mobility pathways. So in other words, they're for work. And some of those are temporary and some of them are permanent. With this visa, it would let anybody, no matter what their age, whether or not they can work, whether or not they have a disability, that it would enable all those people to move to Australia. But as I mentioned, people themselves will have mixed reasons for why they might want to come to Australia. So for some people, it might be a partly economic decision or an educational decision to get their kids into schools in Australia. People will likely send money home to family and community, known as remittances, which in turn can help to support the community back in Tuvalu. And it could be too that people do go back and take those skills with them to Tuvalu. There is a very long history of mobility within the Pacific.
Now, you just mentioned remittances, and also you mentioned this in your article on The Conversation. Could you please expand on this and how this will be creating more of an economic factor into Tuvalu?
Yes. So within the Pacific, around the world, I should say, but I'm thinking of Tonga in the Pacific, where remittances form a huge part of the economy. Remittances basically mean that people are sending money back home. And sometimes this is directly to family, but also Tuvalu is a very communal society and culture. And it could be that money goes towards supporting sustainable development projects, maintaining social facilities and churches, and really invest in the community more broadly. And I think, you know, for the government of Tuvalu, for a very long time, trying to secure enhanced migration opportunities, in part for people's livelihoods and for remittances, has been a key plank.
Professor at University of New South Wales, Jane McAdam there, speaking with The Wire's Eduardo Jordan. First Nations child advocates are calling on governments to stop failing Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander children. Members of the First Nations Caucus of Children's Commissioners and guardians from across Australia and New Zealand say too many kids are being locked up instead of supported. They're warning that reforms lowering the age of criminal responsibility and reducing access to diversions are re-traumatising children and breaching human rights. The Wire's contributor from Niigata Media, Asad Khan, spoke with Commissioner for Children and Young People, Jacqueline McGowan-Jones, to share her concerns.
The First Nations Commissioners for Children and Young People across Australia are really concerned about the fact that we keep demonising our children in a time when youth crime everywhere in Australia is actually decreasing. So we felt it was important to come to the Justice Reintegration Conference to talk about how we reintegrate our children back into society when they've been mostly on remand, not sentenced, and how do we make sure we keep them out of the justice system in the first place?
So WA especially has faced sustained criticism over its treatment of Aboriginal children in detention. Do you believe the state government is meeting its obligation under the UN Convention on the Rights of the Child?
Not at the moment. They have made big improvements. They have really, really made big improvements. But where we have to really make the investment is before our children and young people go to a prison or detention centre and after they come out to stop them coming back. We must look at the family that is supporting that child and look at the family needs. Because what we know is children are being incarcerated because they aren't being cared for. And this includes children who are in the care of the state. So we've got to do better at trying to support families and putting that really high investment into prevention of contact with the system. So are the kids getting better treatment at Banksia Hill right now? Yes. Is it good enough yet? No. Do we need to stop kids going into detention? Absolutely. We should have raised the age of criminal responsibility. We should be investing early in supporting families to keep their children safe. Instead, we talk about rising youth crime, which is not true. It's actually less than it's ever been. We talk about the families don't parent. These are families with many traumas and they need help to parent and we need to be there to support them. We also talk about the kids have a revolving door into youth justice. That's because we don't support them when they come out. So we've got a long way to go.
What feedback did you hear directly from community members during the roundtable sessions at the conference? Are there any common messages or urgent concerns?
Yes, the common messages are that we are demonising our children, that we should be supporting our children, that we need to put them at the centre, that we don't hear their voice. We don't ask kids what they need. We don't work with the families to help them do better. These are all things we know that need to happen and the community really wants this to happen.
You touched on the regressive policy that increased the likelihood of kids being jailed. What evidence exists to support a different, more rehabilitative approach, and why do you think that this evidence continues to be ignored?
I don't know why it continues to be ignored. We've got over 3,000 recommendations from various inquiries and royal commissions and task forces. We've got evidence from all around the world. Scotland virtually has no children left in prison. Texas is closing prisons. So why are we building more? We have to look at the economics. It costs way more to keep a child in custody than it does to give them the supports they need to keep them safe and happy and healthy.
What action would you like to see the government take in the next, let's say, 6 to 12 months to, you know, show it's serious about protecting, especially Aboriginal children's rights?
Really investing in the upstream programs that prevent our children experiencing harm, including the harm of involvement in the criminal system and being incarcerated. We really need to invest in supporting them early. We take children into out-of-home care. Many of them end up in prison. That's not a home. That's not a caring, loving place. Children tell me all they need is someone to care for them. Let's work as a community and a society to make sure every child has someone who cares for them, and that means supporting families so children can stay home.
That was Commissioner Jacqueline McGowan-Jones speaking with Nagada Media's Asad Khan. And unfortunately, that is the end of today's show. Thanks so much for listening wherever you are in Australia. The Wire is a co-production between community radio stations 2SER in Sydney, Radio Adelaide, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Brisbane. With the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and Community Radio Network. Check out all of our stories on our website at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. The Wire acknowledges the traditional custodians of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nations, where the program has been produced. And we pay our respects to Aboriginal elders past, present and emerging. I'm Amina Shakir coming to you from 4EB in Melbourne, Victoria. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next time on The Wire.